Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hello and welcome. I'm Marianne Fox, Chancellor of the University of California, San Diego. It's my pleasure to introduce you to a new year-long series celebrating UC San Diego's 50th anniversary. We've accomplished a lot in the last five decades, catapulting UC San Diego to the top of public universities in the nation. As you will see, there is extraordinary work being done here every day. So stay with us for UCSD at 50. The University of California has a threefold mission of research, teaching, and public service. Our first story shows all three in action. It's about the Center for Community Well-Being, a cross-disciplinary group of UC San Diego faculty, staff, students, and community members who work together to improve the lives of school-aged children in southeastern San Diego.
The Center for Community Well-Being is new as an entity. It was just established this year. But it goes back, the history goes back many, many years.
Like many at UCSD, Social Sciences Dean Jeff Ellman has long cared about the quality of education in California, seeing the state's public schools as UC's pipeline. After launching the Preuss School on the UCSD campus 11 years ago, that's the successful college prep school for low-income but highly motivated students, educators at UCSD turned their attention to community schools. Among them, Gompers in the southeastern neighborhood of Choyas View, then a low-performing middle school, and now, like Preuss, a college prep charter school in partnership with UCSD. Test scores have improved since Gompers went charter, but Ellman and others found there was more to be done.
I had a discussion with Bud Meehan, who has headed that effort, and Mike Cole. And they said they had come to realize through discussion with parents that what happens in the classroom is not just a function of the things that occur within the school boundaries.
There are other factors in students' lives. Neighborhood safety, the health, both physical and mental, of students, whether or not there are good job opportunities in the neighborhood. And we're trying to expand our work into each of those areas.
This led to what has now become the Center for Community Well-Being. It's a holistic approach. It recognizes that in order to improve the life chances, the opportunities for students, even if one is focused mainly on education, you have to recognize that there's a very complicated network of forces, and you can't simply address one of the factors that participates in that network. You've got to look at all of them.
So we've reached out and found colleagues who bring research expertise and a general commitment, and they come from a wide spectrum of the campus, the social sciences. We have people from Jacobs School of Engineering and Cal IT2, who, although they have an engineering expertise, and it's deep and profound, recognize that there aren't technical solutions to the issues that we're talking about.
It turns out there are lots of projects going on in these communities that have been disconnected. So one of the things we're trying to do is provide some glue and coordination.
In addition to that, we've been involving our students because we believe, and I think the research shows, that students who experience what they're learning directly have an enhanced understanding of the content that they're engaged in.
What are some of the issues related to graduation rates for the different groups?
In this CCW-affiliated class, Rafael Hernandez teaches undergraduates how to be effective tutors, lessons that Alyssa Vasquez applies at Gompers.
Good afternoon, Ms. Vasquez.
CCW chooses to work with partners in southeastern San Diego for a very particular reason. We do not want to be in the position from the university, especially the big university on the hill, of imposing our will or imposing our concerns on a community. It's much more advantageous for all concerned, for the community and for the university, if the issues that we address are meaningful for the community members themselves.
A partnership with Project Safeway, a volunteer group that patrols streets near area schools, led to the CCW's first community market, offering free food and clothing to local residents.
Okay, so who are my 10 personal greeters?
Right here.
Just based on our relationships with folks in the community, we realize that there's an urgency right now, that families are in crisis given the economic recession, the loss of jobs. Families are just literally struggling putting food on the table.
Almost all the kids who live in this area qualify for food assistance at school, free lunches at school. If they're not going to school, no free lunch. So then the families who themselves are pushed for just providing clothing and food for their kids and themselves, they don't have that extra resource that the school would regularly bring them.
There are real questions about how best to strategically try to improve the situation. That's where the role that we play as a university comes in. So in addition to trying to intervene and help provide social service, we're not a social service agency, although we'd like to be able to think that we do contribute. We're also a research university.
Ready? Mm-hmm. Are you ready? Mm-hmm. You tell me you're ready.
For Michael Cole, a professor in communication who studies human cognition, his primary research location is the Town and Country Learning Center, based in a public housing complex in Mountain View. Here, Cole oversees undergraduate and graduate students as they work with community members on finding effective ways to use technology in settings like this to improve learning, a partnership that has impressed its director, Beverly Anderson.
It's been wonderful. We both have the same goal in mind, and that was to help the kids to have proper assistance with their homework, as well as social support and help with other things other than just doing the homework.
And in the next room, students can work on projects with UCSD engineering students under the guidance of Srinivas Sukumar. One that brings special pride is this, a kid-friendly 9-screen video wall.
As we looked at what the children's needs are in this particular community, this is a walled-off community. There's a lot of gangs, gang activity, and also drug activity and so on. So families don't feel comfortable letting their children go and wander around in the neighborhood. So one of the ideas is that we would want to use this particular display as a window into the world. We're also thinking from a research standpoint in communication, if there are several of these in various different community centers, are people going to be able to use this as a way of organizing themselves as a community?
A community that now includes students from North and Southeastern San Diego.
The students that come here from the university are pretty close in age to my teens and preteens. They're very young. And even though they don't look like my kids, most of my community is maybe 88% African American, they get to interact with these students in a way that they will never get to interact with college students. I try to share my stories about college, and the kids are like, whatever, you're old. But when a student comes in and says, you know, this is what I'm going through, and they really talk about it and they really connect with the students, they become a vehicle of getting these kids really interested in higher education, which is really cool.
The students, in many ways, are the bridge, the connection between what happens on campus and what happens in these community efforts. This is not simply an opportunity for students to do something that's valuable, and it is, but we also want them to understand that we don't know always the best way to do what we try to do. We don't know the best way to improve education. And so there's a question there that they can help us answer. We're also studying what works. That's very important because we would like at the end of the day not only to have made some contribution to the San Diego communities, but to have learned some things that are exportable. That's what universities do, so that other places can learn the lessons that we've learned here.
My name is Giancarlo Ruiz, and I am the media specialist at the Visual Arts Department here at UCSD. When I'm not here at UCSD, I'm doing films and acting. This last May, I was very fortunate to have my film St. Jacques be selected for the Short Film Corner program at the Cannes Film Festival in France. Basically, it's a love story between two dead people, and they're in the limbo and they're trying to go to the next step. It's a little bit of a surreal story, and it deals with love and loss and letting go. Why am I a filmmaker? Because I think it's a very complete medium. I don't think I was ever too good at something specifically. So I tried painting, I tried playing musical instruments, I tried doing a lot of things that I wasn't really good at. And I think the idea of sitting in a dark environment and watching this huge screen and watching like a story unfold within a time frame is very interesting. And the things that you can do and the way you can somehow, by pressing a button, you can manipulate or change the way you think about the world.
Hi! Have a hug? Oh, thank you.
Ilan Medina has hugs to spare. Like most three-year-olds, he's peppy and playful. But relating with others didn't come naturally for the little boy with autism. He's been working with behavioral therapists 5 days a week since he was 20 months old. It may look like simple play, but the therapy has taught Ilan how to communicate basic needs.
It's Ilan's turn.
Oh, here you go.
Thanks.
You're welcome. We were playing with the puzzle earlier, and I was asking him for a turn, and as soon as I was done, and he'd ask for a turn back, which is something that we had to teach him how to do and learn that play does go back and forth.
It's a tough road, but when you see that the actions speak louder, meaning he's starting to talk, he's starting to make more eye contact, those are the rewards. Those are the things that make you say, we're doing the right thing. We're catching it early.
Lena Medina credits her son's early intervention to the UCSD Autism Center of Excellence. Ilan is part of research headed up by Karen Pierce and Eric Corshane.
So it's almost as if it could be a marker or signature of autism, because almost every one of these is outside the range of normal.
Exactly. So this is pretty exciting.
Corshane and Pierce are making game-changing discoveries about autistic spectrum disorders, which strike almost 1 in 100 children. In 2003, Corshane discovered the young autistic brain grows faster than typical brains, documenting a defect for the first time.
It's beginning to look like we have explanations for why the brain goes wrong early on. And I think we also have explanations for how kids recover and why they recover and what could be done to improve recovery. So this is the most exciting period of my entire career.
At just 4 years old, polio briefly left Corshane unable to walk. He knew from the age of 6 he wanted to help children with developmental disorders. Corshane has been studying autism since 1980, when its cause was still believed to be bad parenting rather than brain abnormalities.
About how long has he been asleep?
About 15 minutes now.
On this night, the MRI team will conduct a third scan on Ilan Medina. The Autism Center pioneered a way to scan normally fidgety autistic children in a machine that requires stillness. Blue lights, hushed voices, and soothing gestures are designed to keep Ilan asleep while technicians watch how his brain responds. The little boy is hearing nursery rhymes piped through high-tech headphones.
It's time for bed, little goose, little goose. The stars are out and on the loose. It's time for bed, little cat, little cat. So snuggle in tight, that's right, like that.
Every single major type of brain imaging that could be done is just about what we're doing here in a single night with a sleeping baby. And it's unbelievable
The researchers have found that autistic brains have an overactive right hemisphere that seems to interfere with the left hemisphere's role in language and social interaction.
It's super exciting because if you have biology as your objective criteria for determining who's going to be autistic or not, that's pretty ironclad. Whereas if you're just looking at a behavior sample, maybe a child is tired that day, or, you know, that is more subject and prone to error, and that really you have to wait until a child's a little bit older.
Thank you so much for coming to play with us today. We're really looking forward to it.
Pierce is developing a more portable diagnostic test that tracks eye movement. An infrared light beam catalogs Elan's gaze. Pierce has found that autistic children prefer geometric patterns over organic movements, like a person dancing on screen. One day, this eye-tracking test, along with functional MRI, could prove to be early diagnostic tools. There are currently no medical tests for autism, so doctors rely on behavior. Pierce is collaborating with 150 pediatricians who now screen patients earlier and refer at-risk kids to the Autism Center.
So this is a very important questionnaire because the development is really going rapidly right now.
Dr. Robert Bjork discusses the developmental checklist with the Ibarra family. As part of Mia's 12-month checkup, her parents answer a simple questionnaire.
And when you're not paying attention, she might do something to get your attention, like make a noise or throw something.
The UCSD Autism Center has collected 10,000 screenings. They're proving invaluable. 37 infants were at risk for autism at 12 months. After behavioral therapy, 5 of those children no longer appeared autistic when they turned 3. Typically, children aren't even diagnosed by that age.
Even though we've evaluated 10,000 children, if we save one from going on to having major, you know, life-debilitating language skills, then it's a worthwhile benefit, I think.
I do think we're on the path to being able to make huge gains for all the babies with autism. Right now, I think it's a very small percentage that can, you know, really make so many gains that they don't even meet the criteria anymore. However, I do think that the vast majority of kids with autism will move to a much more positive place after early treatment.
Ready?
Ilan is making big strides through therapy, but still shows some repetitive behavior and difficulty socializing. The Autism Center is looking for brain signals and genes to explain why some kids fare better than others. Even so, Lena Medina feels research and early intervention brought back her son, an affectionate boy who once didn't want to be hugged or held.
I love you, Ilan.
I love you, Mom. Mom, be with it.
Scripps Institution of Oceanography is proud to be part of UC San Diego's founding, which was spearheaded by my famous predecessor, Scripps Director Roger Avell. The segment you're about to see highlights two of Scripps' most important research areas. The first segment outlines our efforts to discover potential new drugs and pharmaceuticals to treat diseases that may be possible as a result of our exploration of microorganisms in the sea. The second segment looks at Scripps Oceanography's use of robotic instruments in the world's oceans, to help us examine our climate system and climate predictability. Thank you for spending a few minutes to better understand the important work we are doing here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and UC San Diego.
There have been virtually no new antibiotics discovered since 1990. And the result has been that bacterial infections have become an enormous problem, an epidemic problem.
And in one sense or another, 70% of the drugs that we currently use to treat disease are deriving from natural products. A good proportion, maybe a quarter, are natural products directly, but an even larger proportion are drugs that are synthetic in origin, but are mimicking or borrowing, are inspired by some structural feature that's been found in a natural product.
We've got this whole new resource for these organisms covering 70% of the earth, never explored before. And now we can find new drugs for these infections that have never been seen before.
What we're doing here is very early stage. We're doing the basic discoveries. We're going out in the field and collecting samples by scuba diving, bringing them back into the laboratory, and then analyzing them for their bioactive compounds. For instance, we'll screen the extracts. We'll extract the oily-like materials and screen them for anti-cancer activity or anti-inflammatory activity, antibiotic activity.
We've moved on to a new resource, which is renewable and scalable. So these are the microbes. And because these are novel genetically, they produce novel molecules. And those molecules haven't been seen before. They give us an enormous potential for drug discovery. And consistently, we then grow these organisms in significant scale. And we can produce them in the laboratory with no environmental impact whatsoever.
I think it's fair to say that between our various groups, we have a dozen or more really exciting compounds that for which there's patent protection and there's pharmaceutical industry involvement, and that we can expect to see in the not-so-distant future several of these emerge from the academic labs and really go into the clinical setting. So I think we're going to see drugs reach the market in the next 10 years from these efforts. And that's very exciting.
The wonder of having a fantastic institution of oceanography, an incredibly highly respected school of medicine and school of pharmacy, has created an interchange of ideas and opportunities that I think just don't exist anywhere else. And it changes how we appreciate and understand the goal of our fundamental research.
In order to make measurements below the ocean surface before the invention of the profiling float, you had to have a ship, so it just wasn't possible to make measurements at very many places at any one time. The robotic instruments remove that constraint, so now once you've put a float out in the ocean, that's going to operate up and down through the water column. It goes down to 2,000 meters, drifts for 10 days, comes up to the sea surface making measurements of temperature and salinity all the way up, and then immediately transmits that data by satellite back to the global data centers where it can be made immediately available.
And the next technology is spray. That's an underwater glider. It profiles vertically in the same way by changing buoyancy. But what it does is it has wings. And so as it's going up and down, it can fly horizontally on this wings in a similar way to gliders in the air fly. What the glider is essentially a float where we can keep it where we want it. And so the role of gliders is to provide lots of profiles in certain special places. So all the data that comes back from the glider, it's coming by satellite. We get it. We immediately make it available on the web. And so actually right now, the public can go onto our website and they can see plots of all the data we're taking. It really is science happening right now.
Robotics have made it possible for us to make measurements, high-quality measurements, any place, any time, without having a ship present. In the history of oceanography, there has been one global ocean survey, and that was collected during the World Ocean Circulation Experiment, which took 7 years from 1991 to 1997. And in that seven-year period, WOSE collected about 8,000 to 10,000 temperature salinity profiles. Well, ARGO collects that number every month. And so we get the equivalent of a WOSE survey of the ocean with, frankly, better global coverage every month than we got in that seven-year period. And I think that's the sense in which ARGO has revolutionized not necessarily oceanography, but global ocean observation.
we had the first glider observations of an El Nino off the California coast. And so because the gliders were in the water working all the time, we saw how the El Nino got here, how the water got warmer. And we've already described it, and we've already submitted a paper on our findings of how the gliders observed the El Nino. My goal is to have a network of sprays really all around the whole country's coast, with my first goal to get sprays or underwater gliders in general along the west coast of the U.S., and basically have an observing system off the coast that provides us continuous high-quality observations of the physical environment. And so I think that is the wave of the future, is to make our data widely available right away.
The history of physical oceanography is tied entirely to the technology advances that have occurred in oceanography over the last few decades. And that's where having a high-tech and savvy university like this one really makes a difference.
Next, I'd like to tell you about something that's very important to me. In honor of our 50th anniversary, I'm calling on everyone in the UC San Diego community to perform 50 hours of service over the next year. We introduced the Volunteer 50 Chancellor's Call to Service program at our staff picnic last month and look forward to getting students and faculty involved when classes start this fall. Alumni and university friends are also encouraged to participate. Our initial goal is to reach 50,000 cumulative volunteer hours as fast as we can. We want to give back to our community, a community that has supported us for five decades.
I'm volunteering for the 50th.
Just let us know what you're doing by recording your volunteer hours online at volunteer50.ucsd.edu. We'll visit other volunteers in future editions of this program. And I'll be back in the spring to let you know how well we've done in meeting our goals and to see the impact we've had in our community. In the meantime, from all of us at UC San Diego, thank you for joining us. I'm Marianne Fox. We look forward to seeing you again next time on UCSD at 50.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.